The World and Everything in It is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Melissa Lycan. I'm a homeschool mom too.
Blair.
Brooks.
And Lee.
We're an Air Force family waking up a day before you on Osan Air Base in South Korea.
We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Voters who don't care for either major party candidate for president could throw their support to a third party candidate.
To abstain from voting for one of the two parties and voting for a third one is communicating dissatisfaction and saying you need to do something different.
Also, an international agreement that's out of this world. Plus, we'll meet a man who trains horses for a very special purpose.
To train a horse that's basically going to be working with the public for the next 15 years.
It's Thursday, October 22nd. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Mary Reichard.
Time now for the news. Here's Kent Covington.
President Trump and Democratic rival Joe Biden will face off tonight in Nashville, but the president is not happy about multiple changes in the second and final debate.
The whole thing is crazy. This commission, I had problems with them 4 years ago where they muted my mic. They did a whole thing. They did this to me already.
The Commission on Presidential Debates announced that at the start of each new topic, one candidate will have his microphone muted while the other delivers his two-minute remarks. But the remainder of each 15-minute block will be open discussion without any muting. And White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany also complained that foreign policy is not on the list of tonight's topics. She accused the commission of deliberately steering away from Trump's foreign policy wins, like recent Middle East peace deals.
He will be bringing up these points, even if the biased debate commission will not be making this the topic of the debate.
Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien said the campaigns had already agreed that foreign policy would be the focus of this debate. Former Vice President Biden spent Wednesday preparing for the debate while his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, campaigned in North Carolina. Harris said Biden will speak tonight directly to the needs of Americans.
He knows that people want to hear about how we're going to help working people get through the end of the month and pay their rent. That's what people care about.
All major networks will cover the debate beginning at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. One topic that the candidates are certain to debate tonight is the COVID-19 pandemic. As the virus accelerates once again in many countries, including the United States, World's Kristen Flavin reports.
The New York Times reports that as of Monday, nearly one-third of all U.S. states had added more cases in the prior week than in any other seven-day stretch. And the pandemic is hitting the Midwest especially hard. The city of Chicago on Wednesday added five more states to its travel quarantine order. As of tomorrow, anyone traveling to the city from Ohio, Texas, Colorado, Delaware, or West Virginia will have to quarantine for 2 weeks. 31 other states and territories were already on that list. In Ohio, more coronavirus patients are now hospitalized than ever before. However, COVID-19 deaths have not risen in the state. But new daily deaths are up in North Dakota, which now has the highest number of cases per capita in the country. Nationally, COVID-19-related deaths have held relatively steady for more than a month at 700 to 800 per day. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
The British government on Wednesday put another 1.4 million people into England's tightest coronavirus restrictions. The South Yorkshire region will face Tier 3 restrictions as of Saturday. But some say that tiered and targeted measures at the regional level are not enough. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer pressed Prime Minister Boris Johnson Wednesday for a nationwide so-called circuit break lockdown.
This may be the last opportunity for the Prime Minister to put in place an effective circuit break. The Prime Minister was too slow in the first phase of this pandemic. He's being too slow again. We cannot repeat this mistake.
But Johnson fired back, saying that Starmer can't say how long circuit break lockdowns would go on, and he can't say how much damage they would do to the British economy.
Areas that have gone into Tier 3, I believe, are already making progress, and areas where there are restrictions in place are also showing signs of progress. We are pursuing, Mr. Speaker, a regional approach, which is the sensible approach for this country.
In the highest risk areas of England, pubs have to close and people are barred from mixing with members of other households. Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have set their own measures, putting circuit break lockdowns in place. The lockdown in Wales takes effect at 6 p.m. tomorrow. And back in Washington, for a second straight day, Senate Republicans tried to bring a streamlined coronavirus relief bill to the floor. Again, Democrats shot it down.
The yeas are 51, the nays are 44, and the motion to table is agreed to.
The $500 billion measure needed 60 votes to advance. The bill included $300 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program for small businesses and a federal boost to jobless benefits, among other things. But Democrats said the package was not a serious effort to address the crisis. And Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called it a fake vote.
Because if, God forbid, the Senate actually considered a real bill to do something real about this overwhelming COVID crisis, it might delay their Supreme Court nominee.
But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell fired back.
If the Senate turns to Judge Barrett's nomination without having advanced another historic rescue package, it will only be because Senate Democrats used the filibuster to kill this aid.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is still negotiating with the White House about a possible coronavirus relief bill worth roughly $2 trillion. The company that makes the opioid OxyContin will plead guilty to three felony charges as part of a settlement worth more than $8 billion. U.S. Attorney for Vermont Christina Nolan said Purdue Pharma's prescription painkiller helped spark America's opioid crisis.
Purdue's expected guilty plea for that conduct will mark the first of its kind in the history of the country, a milestone in our efforts to combat corruption in the healthcare industry and the opioid crisis in America.
She said the company will plead guilty to crimes including conspiracy to defraud the United States and violating federal anti-kickback laws. The opioid addiction and overdose crisis is linked to nearly a half million deaths in the country since the year 2000. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, voting for third-party candidates, plus Cal Thomas with some advice on reforming political debates. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, October 22nd, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Megan Basham. First up, third parties. We hear a lot about Democrats versus Republicans, Biden versus Trump, and many voters avidly support one or the other. But some are dissatisfied with both.
Every election, a few voters opt to cast their ballots for a third party candidate. What's behind that choice, and what effect does it have on elections? World's Anna Johansson reports.
Elias Ganage is a young voter in Northern Virginia. He cast his first ballot in 2016, supporting Marco Rubio for president.
Outside of that, I have voted straight Republican on every candidate, and I've participated in every single election since then. And voted Republican, both local and at the national level.
But on November 3rd, Ganage doesn't plan to vote Republican for president. He says he can't support Donald Trump as the leader of the United States or as the face of the Republican Party. Ganage is also staunchly pro-life, so he doesn't plan to vote for Democrat Joe Biden either.
We make a big claim to stand for morality and to stand for truth and what's right. And because of that, it's vitally important that we choose a leader who exemplifies what we value, not just in what they say, but in their actions.
Ganage says that leaves him with only one option, voting third party. There are dozens of political parties in the United States. The Socialist Workers Party, the Peace and Freedom Party, the United States Pirate Party. There's something for everyone. Each state handles political parties differently. Some require a party to have a certain number of registered voters in order to get a candidate on the ballot. In other states, a party has to file a petition or win a percentage of the vote. Most third-party candidates never make it onto the ballot. Voters can write them in, but they don't get a lot of attention. Right now, the Libertarian Party is the most popular third party in the United States. If you've watched the TV series Parks and Recreation, you might remember this libertarian, Ron Swanson.
Diane, for potholes, you want to speak with Public Works. I understand you've tried them four times. Government is inefficient and should be dissolved.
In real life, libertarians are socially liberal, fiscally conservative. They want smaller government, fewer regulations, more individual rights. This year, Joe Jorgensen is the libertarian candidate for president. A recent poll showed about 5% of American voters backing Jorgensen.
In Joe's America, marijuana is now safe and legal.
Our healthcare system finally sees real competition and falling prices.
You get to keep your paycheck.
You're finally free.
You're finally free.
The Libertarian Party doesn't claim to be pro-life. That's one reason Elias Ganaj isn't voting Libertarian this year.
I cannot support the Libertarian candidate because she definitely is supporting legalized abortion.
Dennis Lowe is a county organizer for the Libertarian Party in upstate New York. He knows Joe Jorgensen won't actually win the presidency, but he wants to keep the door open for future Libertarian candidates. In New York, if you want to have a place on the ballot, your party has to regularly draw a certain number of voters.
So it's very important for every Libertarian in New York to vote for the Libertarian presidential candidate because they have greatly increased our requirement for how many ballots we have to keep a permanent place on the ballot.
Not everyone likes third parties because they pull votes away from the two main candidates. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow at the think tank New America.
So, you know, if the election is between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and you would prefer Joe Biden to Trump, but you vote for a third party candidate, you know, that's a vote that is not going to Joe Biden. So it's effectively helping Donald Trump, who you preferred less.
The spoiler effect is a common objection to third party voting.
At a time in which the elections feel like incredibly high stakes contests, a lot of people do not seem eager to throw away their vote. And as a result, you don't see strong candidacies for third parties, recognizing that it's going to be hard to mount any sort of challenge and any sort of serious campaign under such conditions.
Advocates of the two main parties don't want to lose voters that could tip the election one way or the other. Here's Michelle Obama speaking at the Democratic National Convention.
This is not the time to withhold our votes in protest or play games with candidates who have no chance of winning.
But many third-party voters say that's only looking at the short-term effect instead of thinking long-term. Here's Elias Ganaj.
Every election cycle, everyone says this is the most important one ever.
In 2016, what if more evangelicals had voted third-party instead of straight Republican?
Maybe it would have meant Clinton would have won, and that would have had some major implications. But the next election cycle, the Republican Party would do a much better job of trying to court the evangelical vote.
Voting third party is usually a form of dissent or protest. Ganaj hopes his vote, and others like it, will spark change.
To abstain from voting for one of the two parties and voting for a third one is communicating dissatisfaction in the candidate and saying, well, you need to do something different.
At the end of the day, Dennis Lowe says it depends on what you want to do with your ballot. You can vote as a political statement. You can vote for the person you think is most qualified, or the one you agree with the most, or the one with the best shot at winning.
Because there's that descriptor in front of vote, your vote, right? So it's yours to cast however you want.
Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, exploring outer space. On Tuesday, a U.S. spacecraft gathered samples from the asteroid Bennu. It'll deliver them back home in 2023. Bennu, like many asteroids, contains natural resources that could be mined to fuel deep space exploration.
Mining space resources could eventually become common practice, but earthly laws aren't quite adequate to regulate such an otherworldly enterprise. NASA hopes an agreement signed last week will provide a new foundation for exploring, working, and even living in outer space. World correspondent Bonnie Pritchett has our report.
What we are all seeking is the peaceful uses of outer space, the peaceful process of getting to the moon, and then enshrine these principles into a document that we all agree to.
That's NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine talking to reporters last week after he and the leaders of seven national space agencies signed the Artemis Accords. The brief document lists 13 principles guiding NASA's mission to the moon, Mars, and beyond. It's known as the Artemis Program. Nations wanting to collaborate in that endeavor must sign the accords.
文部科学大臣の萩生田光一です。本日署名するアルテミス合意は
NASA drafted the agreement with input from nations eager to join the mission. They are Australia, Canada, Italy, Japan, Luxembourg, the United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. The virtual signing ceremony took place October 13th during the annual meeting of the International Astronautical Congress. Noticeably missing from the signatories, Russia and China. A 2011 amendment authored by then-Representative Frank Wolf prohibits bilateral collaboration between NASA and China or Chinese-owned companies, so Beijing isn't allowed to participate.
So as you remember, the head of Russia's space agency, Dmitry Rogozin, said that
And Moscow might not be able to afford to, at least for now. Michelle Hanlon co-directs the University of Mississippi Center for Air and Space Law. She believes Russia will eventually sign the accords because of its decades-long cooperative efforts with the United States in outer space. Since 1967, five treaties have regulated human space activity. The first, commonly called the Outer Space Treaty, is the foundation for the Artemis Accords. Hanlon explains.
It didn't have rules so much as principles and guidelines. And among those principles and guidelines, it was pretty vague. Space will be used for peaceful purposes. We won't militarize space.
Though not a treaty, the new accords address principles of extraterrestrial cooperation, including the peaceful exploration of space, the interoperability of space-based infrastructures, shared scientific data, and the establishment of safety zones to avoid harmful interference between nations. Hanlon said the accords clarify a point of disagreement in the 1967 treaty.
Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty says no sovereign state may appropriate territory in space, period. Nobody argues with that provision. What it doesn't say is what happens if you want to use the resources of space.
Bridenstine gave a down-to-earth explanation.
We also think it's important to make sure that when countries go to the moon and other celestial bodies, they're able to extract resources. We want to be clear. Under the Artemis Accords, there is nobody interested in appropriating the moon or other celestial bodies for national sovereignty. You can extract resources from the ocean, but it doesn't mean that you own the ocean.
Research indicates there could be enough water ice at the moon's south pole to provide water and oxygen for long-term human habitation on the lunar surface. It could also provide hydrogen for fuel. And once those international colonies are established on the moon and Mars, they'll need lawyers.
The world needs space lawyers. I know people kind of giggle at that, but it really does. Right now, you don't lose your nationality when you go to space. So the way station does it is in each module, whoever created that module, those laws apply. So if you cross over into the Russian module, you are abiding by Russian law. So it will have to be hashed out by treaty how they're going to do it.
Hanlon said laws governing a fledgling international community on the moon will probably model the laws of the International Space Station initially, but that other world community will eventually outgrow an agreement like the Artemis Accords.
One of the really interesting questions we face that I put to my students in my space law class is, what about crime? Like, at what point does that community on the moon become its own sovereign?
And hammering out detailed laws world leaders can agree on will likely be an out-of-this-world challenge. Reporting for World, I'm Bonnie Pritchett.
4, 3, 2, 1, Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling,
Cars boast some impressive safety features, thanks to creative engineers who put their minds to these things. But what if I told you there's a Beetle that can withstand being run over by a truck and take on almost zero damage? Well, the world's most renowned engineer has designed a protective shell that can withstand compression up to 39,000 times its own weight. Now, take note here. His creation is not a Volkswagen Beetle. It's an actual Beetle. Scientists are studying our creator's remarkably intelligent design of the Nosoderma diabolicum Beetle, or the diabolical ironclad beetle, as it's known. Researchers put the insect's armor to the test, even running over it with a car. And then using electron microscopes, they discovered the ironclad beetle's secret. It has jigsaw-like bindings and a layered architecture that make it nearly uncrushable. Scientists hope that decoding the beetle's design may lead to safer and more durable cars and planes. It's the world and everything in it. Today is Thursday, October 22nd. You're listening to World Radio, and we're so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Megan Basham. 21st century policing. These days, we use body cameras, facial recognition, software, and drones. But some departments around the country are returning to a much older method of policing, horses.
World's senior correspondent Myrna Brown introduces us to a man who spent more than half of his life helping to fuel this equine comeback.
Is that what that is?
It's lunchtime at Fitch's IGA. More than a grocery store, this is where people in Wilmore, Kentucky get their milk, tools, and blue plate specials.
He's next. Well, we want pot pie dinner and two chicken dinners.
Harold Rainwater is one of the regulars. After lunch, we took a ride down Main Street, where rows of cherry blossom trees line the sidewalk.
Mom and Dad had a dime store right there. Right there. 5 and 10 store. My dad had a shoe repair shop right there, where the law office is. Our parents owned this restaurant.
Rainwater was born and raised in this town of 6,000. And like his parents did, the 74-year-old wears many hats.
I've been mayor for 44 years. I've been in horses for about that same amount of time.
When Rainwater became mayor of Wilmore in 1976, he also started teaching at what was then Asbury College. That's when he says he got the idea to start an equine program at the Christian Liberal Arts School.
When you first presented it to the college...
It wasn't just no, it was no emphatically. Because in Kentucky, when you say horse, you're basically talking about a racehorse. And around a racehorse is basically gambling. And Asbury just did not want that tie.
Rainwater says he understood the resistance, but he stayed focused on the bigger picture.
I just didn't take no. I felt God had given me a call, and that was to start an equine program. So I basically just went out and got some private property and started a program on the side.
He ran that program for more than a decade, often using his own money to support his fledgling equine program. Then, in 1998, the college gave him permission to start operating the program from the campus. 343 acres of rolling hills alongside the Kentucky River.
And so we were, like, taking in horses and selling a few and training a little bit and doing trail rides. And
Rainwater says student interest was slow at first.
So I started with two minors and one dropped out. So I had one.
Still struggling to find enough income to sustain it, Rainwater pursued a proposal to rescue, train, and sell unwanted foals or baby horses headed for slaughter.
There was just something exciting about taking an animal that nobody wanted and making them something that a lot of people want. The only thing that didn't happen is they never did have the sale, and they never did promote us, and no one ever wanted our horses because they weren't trained.
But that wasn't the end of the story. In 2007, 11 students declared equine studies as their major, and Rainwater got an unexpected request from the United States Border Patrol.
Could you train some horses for us? We already own the horses, we just want them trained. So I heard you have students, and they brought me two horses to train. And then another department said, I heard you're training for the Border Patrol, would you train ours? So we had another department. So that became our new little niche. And
today, more than two dozen police departments across the nation use service mounts trained by Rainwater's students.
I would never dream that this program would be one of the largest programs at Asbury. It would be influencing people around the nation. It would be putting police horses literally around the world, well, at least Canada and U.S., and it would be growing at the numbers. We had 40 freshmen come in last year, so we're really blessed.
So if you have his head to the right.
In 2014, Rainwater added a renowned horse trainer to his team. Jesse Westfall teaches students like Olivia Schnorbus and Hope Beers. Today, they're training King and Kaiser, three-year-old bay-colored gelding horses.
It's kind of hard to put in perspective what we're doing because no one else is doing it.
Need it? Oh, you say get it.
Uh-huh.
What are you saying and why are you saying that?
We try to, like, encourage their curiosity and make them braver. So, like, ever since he was little, I've been saying that phrase, get it, when we're going up to an obstacle that he might think is scary.
Every day for the past 2 years, Schnorbus and Beers have been using 8-inch wooden boxes and bright orange barrels to build trust and to prepare their buddies for life beyond country hills and pastures.
Go, boy.
And hopefully we're instilling that in them, that that you have a unique opportunity to train a horse that's basically going to be working with the public for the next 15 years and impacting how many people. That's the gift you give them, is teach trust. I think that's a life lesson that you can preach and teach.
Reporting for World, I'm Myrna Brown in Wilmore, Kentucky.
One month after these interviews, King and Kaiser left Wilmore, Kentucky to begin their new lives as police horses. Myrna followed them to their new home and returns next week for that part of their story.
Additional support comes from ChristianBook.com. Christian books, Bibles, music, toys, and gifts at ChristianBook.com.
Coming up next, an excerpt from tomorrow's episode of Listening In. This week, host Warren Smith talks with apologist Justin Bailey. Bailey's a professor of theology at Dort University. He's also the author of Reimagining Apologetics, The Beauty of Faith in a Secular Age.
In this excerpt of their conversation, he suggests a shift in how to approach conversations about faith. Here's Warren Smith.
Traditional apologetics might say something like this. These are the 20 reasons that we can believe Jesus was raised from the dead. Or these are the 10 key reasons that we can believe in the authority of Scripture.
Another way to say it would be that the traditional way of doing apologetics is interested in apologetics as sort of a science, whereas I'm interested in apologetics as an art. And there's an art to persuasion, and there's an art to conversation, and there's an art to engaging people in their imagination and not just in their intellect. Now, that doesn't mean that we do away with the science. The science gives us method. It gives us content. But we all know, those of us who are in relationships with people who might find themselves all over the spectrum of belief or unbelief or perhaps they belong to another religion, that belief is a lot more than just ideas. There's a whole social, relational, cultural context, which is the soil of belief. It's the context in which beliefs become believable. And so simply to give somebody a list of reasons why they should believe without engaging that imaginative existential context is really to do them a disservice. It's interesting. It's also not the way that faith is presented to us, is it? The Bible is not given to us in bullet point form. Perhaps maybe we wish it was. We wish that there was just, these are the things that you should believe, because maybe we would argue less. But what God has done instead is given us really a narrative form, a story of how he has engaged with the history of Israel and has showed up in the person of Jesus Christ and has worked through the Holy Spirit and the church. And this is the primary form that we're given, is this story, which requires us to use our intellect, of course, but it's prior to that, it requires us to engage our imagination.
That's Justin Bailey talking to Warren Smith. To hear their complete conversation, look for Listening In tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts. Today is Thursday, October 22nd. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Megan Basham. Commentator Cal Thomas now with some suggestions for the people running the presidential debates.
The supposedly nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates has selected the following topics for tonight's final encounter between President Trump and Joe Biden. Fighting COVID-19, American families, race in America, climate change, national security, and leadership. The commission also announced it will mute the microphone of the candidate who is not talking. The president opposes that rule, but it could be to his advantage, since the more Biden talks, the less clear he becomes. But are these topics priorities for most voters? Not according to the Pew Research Center. They found nearly 8 in 10 registered voters say the economy is their number one issue, followed by healthcare, Supreme Court nominees, the virus, and foreign policy. Race and ethnic inequality come in at number 8, and climate change ranks next to last. Voters should be allowed to select the topics of greatest concern to them, not political elites who are likely still getting their paychecks while many Americans have lost jobs. Race in America is too broad a topic. The president might say that Biden and other Democrats have not fixed the racial divide yet. Biden's held elected offices for 47 years. Why should he be expected to do better if he becomes president? After all, he opposes school choice, which would open the door to a better future for disadvantaged children trapped in failing public schools. Trump clearly enjoys an advantage in the national security category. He's brokered a deal between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Israel. He's ending America's involvement in foreign wars. He's imposed serious sanctions on Iran. He's also made European nations pay more for their own defense. As for leadership, I assume that will give Biden an opportunity to claim he can bring us together. What does that mean? Does it mean Republicans must abandon their beliefs? Better to win the argument over whose ideas work and whose have not than to embrace a group hug. The president should take advantage of this topic to say what the next 4 years would look like, especially with a Republican Congress, should he win re-election. The preparations for tonight's debate clearly show the debate commission is ready for retirement. It is 60 years old and has exceeded its sell-by date. Instead, the candidates themselves should drive the debates. They should each get 30 minutes to outline and explain their ideas. They could then question each other. If we must have moderators, let each candidate pick one, not the commission. The political elites and insiders are still running too much of our political system. The public would be better served if we adopted serious reforms in how we elect presidents. That should be the goal. I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow, Culture Friday with John Stone Street. And I'll review a new documentary that Amazon originally didn't want on their platform. That and more tomorrow. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Mary Reichert. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Don't be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Thanks for listening, and please join us again tomorrow.